starting on the 28th verse of the 9th chapter of Luke. Came to pass about an 8 days after these sayings, he took Peter and John and James and went up into a mountain to pray. As he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistering. And behold, there talked with him two men, which were Moses and Elias, or Elijah, who appeared in glory and spake of his decease, which he should accomplish at Jerusalem. But Peter and they that were with him were heavy with sleep. And when they were awake, they saw his glory and the two men that stood with him. It came to pass as they departed from him, Peter said unto Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, one for Elias, not knowing what he said. While he thus spake, there came a cloud and overshadowed them, and they feared as they entered into the cloud. And there came a voice out of the cloud, saying, This is my beloved Son, hear him. And when the voice was passed, Jesus was found alone. They kept it close and told no man in those days any of those things which they had seen. As you read the Gospels of Jesus Christ, the first four books of the New Testament, one of the things you'll notice, if you just pay a little bit of attention, that's not unusual for Jesus to go into a mountain to pray or a mountain to get away from people. There's a few places I'd just like to point your attention to just briefly so that you'll see the pattern here. Jesus went to a mountain and prayed when he considered who he would call to be his who he would appoint as his disciples. Luke 6:12-13 it says, Came to pass in those days that he went out into a mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called unto him his disciples, and of them he chose 12, whom also he named apostles. Now, Jesus also went to the mountain to preach. We call it the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:1. Seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him. Now, after the feeding of the 5,000, when the people desperately misunderstood the ministry of Jesus, and they wanted to make him a king. This is what we read in John 6:15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Now, one last place is when Jesus just wanted to be alone in Matthew 14. It says, Straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship and go before him into the other side, and while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. So Jesus' actions here in this ninth chapter of Luke, and I believe, if I'm correct, also you can find it in the 17th chapter of Matthew, and it's also found in Mark. The three synoptic gospels all have this same account in it. Some of them give a little bit more detail, some less. But you can watch Jesus as he moves to the mountain. There was something about the mountaintop that was very important for him. As a matter of fact, it's important all through the Bible. Abraham went to the mountaintop. Moses went to the mountaintop. Elijah went to the mountaintop. These mountaintop experiences were something that was rather common, at least as you look at it in the confines of what the scriptures give us. The scriptures don't give us all the accounts of everything that happened in everybody's life, but it does appear that it was pretty common that people would go to the mountain when they wanted to be able to talk to God, or when they just wanted to get away from everything. A need of silence sometimes is true for most people. There's a few people that live for noise. Every now and then it's nice to have silence. I don't know how you feel about everything in life, but there's times where I just don't like to even turn the radio on. I just shut everything off, and I can drive like that for quite a ways. Now, I know some of you can never do that. I was talking to my son-in-law one time, and we were talking about the way guys talk to each other. I said, well, James and I can go somewhere, and we might drive for miles and not even say a word to each other because we just don't have anything to say. And he said, oh, I never could do that, man. Why wouldn't you want to talk? And I think, well, that's my son-in-law. He likes to talk to people. I mean, he's just one of those guys that just is a talker. But for me, I kind of like silence every now and then. And it's nice not to be overwhelmed with all the noises of everything that comes in life. Now, in this particular instance that we read about here in Luke 9, it's called the Transfiguration. And this moment, or this is a moment that Peter and James and John were allowed to participate in. This inner circle of disciples have had the opportunity to be with Jesus in some very special moments. And in this particular moment, Jesus' actual physical appearance is altered. There's a shining about him. About his clothing, about his face. The Bible talks about his countenance was changed. And so there's an altering that takes place that is amazing to these individuals. And again, it's so amazing that it's included in three of the three synoptic gospels. I like to look at the individuals who were present with Jesus. I think as we look at who was there, it tells us something about what the importance of what we see is for us. What that implies to us, what that tells us in our lives, what it means to us. So we're going to just look at these individuals that were there with him, and I'm not going to do it in order. When you put the sermon together yourself, you can do it any way you want to, you know. So I'm not going to do it in order, but I would like for you to note firstly that about the presence of Moses and Elijah. Now, I don't know all that took place at the Transfiguration. We're given pieces of it. We don't see everything, but we get to see some of it. And Moses and Elijah appear in what the King James version translates as glory. As glory. I don't know really why that word is used. That word is doxa. And we sing the doxology, which brings glory to God, and has the idea of honor and praise and even worship. And as I look at this, I wonder how the disciples knew who those two guys were. Now let's face it, Elijah and Moses is about 1,500 years prior to this time frame that we're looking at. And Elijah, if I remember correctly, is probably about 700 years. So this is, we're looking at this, at least a 700 year time period. They didn't have photographs to look at. You know, there was no school of prophets that would open up the prophets' photographs. They didn't say, come and see the ones that have gone before us. Now here's this one and here's that one. They didn't have any etchings. They didn't have any paintings. They didn't have anything like that. And so the question in my mind, and maybe you couldn't care less, but in my mind, I'm wondering how they know. How they know this is not just, Uncle George and his neighbor. How they know it's Moses and Elijah. Well, the indication seems to be that God has revealed this simply through the glory of who they are and what's going on at the moment. At some point, whether it's that night or a later date, God lets them know that Moses and Elijah have been with Jesus on the mountaintop. And then the question becomes, why them? Why not two others? Why not Abraham and Joseph? Why not Isaiah and Jacob? Why not some of these other mighty, wonderful leaders that that have been presented to us all through the scriptures. Why not these other great men? Why those two? Well, it appears that one reason Moses was chosen was because he is the one that God used to bring the law to the people. See, the law is one of the major moments for all peoples when God presented his law for his people. This moment shifts everything in the prior history and changes everything in the future history. That moment when Moses is on the mountain and the Ten Commandments are given to him, and as he's in the wilderness and all the other pieces of the law are provided for him, that changes the people of Israel. They become more than just a tribe of people who worship a God that they know, but they have some of their own abilities just to choose how they serve, because all of those things aren't delineated until that moment. And so Moses represents the law and the presentation of the law. And then Elijah he's the prophet. I mean, he's one of the major prophets that steps forth. He fights the battle against the prophets of Baal. He's the one that you look at and you hear about as you read both Old Testament and New Testament. He seems to represent all the prophets of the past who had stood and who had proclaimed the truth of God. All those prophets that had declared all the things of God, who had talked about the coming Messiah. The ones who had pointed the way. The ones who looked to the future. Who saw dimly the wonders of what God would do. Who grasped it with their hearts and with their minds. Who couldn't tell you everything about it, but they could tell you that one day there would be a child born in the city of Bethlehem. The prophets that could declare that one day there would be a stone cut out of a mountain and that would overcome all the kingdoms of the world. You see, all of those prophets are represented by this Elijah. And then there's Jesus with him. Jesus is the one who is going to fulfill the law and the prophets. He's the one that is going to bring all of those pieces together into the plan of God to where it becomes clearer than it had ever been before. Where they could look at the law and they could see the sacrifices, and they could see why all those sacrifices would one day point to the Messiah. They would look back and they would see Moses when the first Passover came and they slaughtered the lamb and his blood was taken and placed on the doorpost. And somehow, some way, when Jesus walked down by the river Jordan and John the Baptist saw him, he would say, "Behold, the Lamb of God which taketh away the sin of the world." And somehow, that Passover lamb who we know as Jesus fulfills everything in the law. But also, he's the one that fulfills all the prophecies. He's the one that was born at Bethlehem. He's the one that would hang on the cross, who would have no bones broken, who would have his side pierced with the spear, who would have the blood and water come forth, the one that would be in the tomb for 3 days but would rise. This is the one. And so Jesus is fulfilling everything, the law and the prophets. And here's Moses and Elijah talking to him. And we don't know everything that was said, but we do know this, that they talked to him about his decease. I believe I got the word right. talk to him about his death that would come. How they spoke of his decease, which should be accomplished at Jerusalem. Now the term decease there, and I found this very interesting because of what's taken place. The term decease has actually the translation of Exodus. Oh, does that not give all of us thoughts about something wonderful that took place in the Bible? Do we not remember how Israel was captive and how God came and set them free, and they exodused from the nation of Israel? They departed. We talked about, oftentimes you hear people talk about the good departed person that has passed away. We use all of these terms. You know, we're afraid of saying death. And so we say they have departed, the dear departed one here. Well, Jesus departed just like Israel departed. They left the bondage they were in. They crossed the Red Sea. They went through the wilderness 40 days or 40 years. And they spent all that time there. And now suddenly on the Mount of Transfiguration, Elijah and Moses is talking to Jesus. And they talk to him about his decease, about his departure, about his exodus. They were telling him about what was coming. Of course, he knew it. I don't know what the discussion sounded like. Maybe Moses would say something along the line of, Jesus, you know, you're not very many days away from your departure from this world. And Jesus would say, yes, I know. And Elijah would say, you know, it won't be long before your body will be placed on a cross. And you will be crucified there. And death will come to you. And Jesus would say, yes, I know. And they both might have said, you know, you're going to be placed in the tomb. And you realize they're going to roll the stone back. And Jesus would say, yes, but you know that I will depart from this world. The stone will not hold me. I will come out and I will exodus death. Death will be defeated. It will no longer have power over mankind. And friends, on that day, when that took place, I want you to know that Jesus moved through that horrible process of his torture and death. And on the third day, when he conquered death and hell, Satan was shattered by the living Messiah. Salvation was purchased and eternal glory was provided. And then after 40 days, he ascended into what some of us might call the promised land. You see, all those pictures are rolled up into what takes place there. As Elijah and Moses stay up there with him through those moments of time, as they talk to him, as they discuss his departure, they are able to help this one that is the wonderful Messiah that they knew would come. And my brothers and my sisters, while some of the questions we might have might not be answered, why just the law and why just the prophets and why not something else? I would say to you that I do not know that, but I do know this, that Moses and Elijah were seeing the wonders of the grace of God. Now I believe that those men had tasted the grace of God. I believe that they'd seen the wonders of heaven. But friends, that day, as they were on that hillside with Jesus, they saw the amazing grace of God being given to mankind. There's also the presence of the three disciples. As I said a few moments ago, these three disciples were an inner circle with Jesus. Now, while the entirety of the 12 apostles was amazing, these three seem to have played a very unique role in the life of Jesus. This is just one of the examples of their privilege in the ministry of Jesus. Later on, we'll find them in the Garden of Gethsemane with Jesus. In Matthew 26, we read these words, "Then cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane, and saith unto the disciples, Sit ye here while I go and pray yonder. And he took with him Peter and two sons of Zebedee, James and John, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. What happens at that incredible moment of his life? And what takes place on that mountain? And who are the men that are allowed to be there? Peter and James and John. And what do they do? What do? They immediately fall asleep. Isn't that amazing? But why should we be surprised? If you look at the Garden of Gethsemane, you see the same process take place. You see, they were just normal, ordinary, everyday men. I don't know about the stress and strain of what they've been doing. I don't know about all those pieces of things that took place. I know what happened to me today. This past week, last Monday and Tuesday, normally I take Mondays off, I sleep late, and this past Monday I think I got up about 6 o'clock, 6:15, and I got ready and we drove to Kentucky. Got there at the place we were supposed to be at. We had to be there by 1. I had a meeting started at 1, and then I got there I think 12:30, 20 to 1. Started in the meeting. We had the meeting, went up in the evening. Went to bed, got up the next morning, had more meeting, finished up about 10:30 or so, 11 o'clock, then drove back down here, got back here about 4:30. I tell you, last week was a bad week for me. It's hard for me to think the whole week, you know, and then I do what any reasonable person would do on a Saturday morning, during hunting season. I got up at 5:15, so I'd go hunting. Dennis Keene and I went out hunting and didn't see anything but turkeys. That's love to see turkeys, but rather see them during turkey season than deer season, you know. So we went out and I was up through the day and I fell asleep in my chair a couple times and, later on that evening and, then this morning at 5:30, Dell called me up and, woke me up and I was trying to get my head together and, still was in pretty deep sleep, and then I got up. And so this afternoon when I went home, I spent 2 hours praying. Actually, I spent 2 hours sleeping. Yeah. I sat down in the chair. We went over to the chili cook-off, which, by the way, Kristen Shelton won. What? Come on, help me. Kristen, wasn't it? Wasn't Kristen? Yeah, Kristen Shelton won. Yeah, not Christy. Christy got beat by her daughter. Yeah, and so I ate chili, and then I went ahead and we went to the house and I sat down and I went over my sermon, and then after I went over my sermon, I went in and I thought I'd watch whatever might be on TV, flipped it on, and then 2 hours later I woke up. And I wouldn't have woke up then, but I was in my hearing. I heard them on the news talking about the tornadoes in central Illinois, and that woke me up, and I made a few phone calls. Is it any wonder that these men promptly fell asleep? Is it any wonder? I don't know what woke them up. Maybe it's just like me today when in the back of in my mind I heard them talking about the things that resonated in my mind. I knew my children were in central Illinois. And I thought, I wonder how they are. And I forced myself to wake up. I wonder what it is. Did they hear the voice of Jesus as he spoke to Moses and Elijah? Did they hear him say, "Now, Moses, it'll be all right. Elijah, you're a great prophet, but I know what's coming." Did they hear that in their mind and suddenly wake up and get to see what's taking place there that day? as they observe this, as they hear this conversation, they must have been had a sense of overwhelming amazement. Or maybe it might have been the hand of God that shook them and woke them up. Why not just let them sleep? Well, do you recall what the Bible tells us? Deuteronomy 17:6. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. Could it be that Jesus was providing three witnesses all along to fulfill everything in the law? Three witnesses could rise up and say, yes, we heard it. We seen it. It was amazing. It was marvelous. You'll never see anything like it. Maybe Jesus was looking ahead to the day when people would say, ah, something like that can't happen. Oh, you must have been dreaming. No. Peter might say, not only I, but here's James and here's John. Hey, James, tell them what you saw. James, tell them what happened there. John, let them know. Tell them. And brothers and sisters, all the fulfillment of the law was brought forth in that moment. And Peter and James and John were allowed to see this transfiguration. They got to see the King of Glory. And what does Peter figure out? He does what's normal and natural for a man who hasn't figured things out yet, exactly is what he figured out. He just couldn't quite grasp the idea of who Jesus was. And so he says, let's build three tabernacles. Folks, if you're going to build a tabernacle, you don't build it to a man. You build it to God who died for you. Peter says, oh, let's get one for Elijah and one for Moses and one for Jesus. He thinks he's honoring all three of them. And Jesus says, you just don't know what you're saying. And by the way, Luke wrote in 9:33, the last phrase, he says, not knowing what he said. But they got to be there. Well, the last person that was there, other than Jesus, is you have the presence of God. A cloud that is a great cloud, it says, overshadowed them. Now that term overshadow has the idea to envelop in brilliancy. And you can find that in Strong's Talking Greek and Hebrew Dictionary. Now this is very similar to what takes place when Solomon built the temple. Listen to these words. Now when Solomon had made an end of praying, the fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices. And the glory of the Lord filled the house. And the priests could not enter into the house of the Lord because the glory of the Lord had filled the Lord's house. And when all the children of Israel saw how the fire came down, the glory of the Lord upon the house, they bowed themselves with their faces to the ground upon the pavement and worshipped and praised the Lord, saying, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever. The similarity here is at that moment when this great temple of worship was built, the presence of God was so great that people fell on their face. Did you note three different times in those verses? It says the glory of the Lord was there. The glory of the Lord was there. And when God steps into the presence of mankind, note this, man always bows down to God. Always bows down to God. And by the way, that is a precursor to the truth that one day we shall all stand before Christ and every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess. There is the great message of what you and I ought to understand being said here. God is saying, here is my son. Bow down before him. And thus overshadowing took place there. And oh my, What a moment that must have been. In the Old Testament, the priest couldn't enter the house of the Lord because his glory was there. The people bowed down to the ground and worshiped him. And you read here in Luke that Peter and the other two were so afraid that he came up with his plan. But God was there. Why did he come for that moment? He was clearly a participant at the baptism of Jesus. Well, in Matthew 3:17, when he said, "Lo, a voice from heaven saying, 'This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased.'" And again we hear in verse 35 of the 9th chapter of Luke, "This is my beloved Son, hear him." The declaration of God about who Jesus is. He is not the common, ordinary prophet. He is not just a part of Israel. He is not just a leader. He's not a great general. He's not any of these things. He's not a great king in the sense of earthly kings. Rather, this is the Son of God. That's what God says. He places a stamp of approval on the actions of Jesus. He is doing the will of his Father, and God is shouting to the world that he loves his Son. Second, he's saying that he's pleased with his Son. I know you heard that already, but you say, what's the difference? Jesus is his Son. His Son. Those of you that have children, you understand that, or you should. You look at a playground of kids. They're all out there playing and running and jumping. And oh, aren't they unique? Aren't the kids wonderful? In the life of our congregation, we get to see all these wonderful little kids as they run around the building and do all the things they do. And they're so unique in their life. They say things, they do things, they run and they'll hug you. By the way, if you'll let these kids hug you, they will. And but if it's your child in the mix, you'll look across that whole room or that whole playground and you'll see all those kids and you'll think, my, those kids are something, aren't they? But then you'll see yours. And there's something about saying, that's my Son. And here we hear the voice of the Heavenly Father as he speaks out and says, "This is my beloved Son." This is not Elijah, it's not Moses, but it's Jesus. And I'm not for sure if we always grasp that reality. But what this means is that Jesus is God. He is God. You see, God doesn't have hybrid children. Half God, half man. Jesus is holy God. Every bit of him. He put on human flesh. And he came to this world. And God looks at him and said, "That's my boy." And you and I are allowed to hear about it. He is God who has come with the final answer for sin's power. He has come to die on Calvary and to raise from the grave. No wonder God is pleased. See, Jesus is the only sacrifice. Nothing else would do. Here they are on the mountaintop. Oh, we see Elijah and Moses, and what a wonderful moment they had. And we see the three disciples or apostles as they are there with Jesus. And we watch the reaction and sense the confusion that Peter has. But then we see God. And very clearly, he lets us know, "This is my Son." Yeah. Boy, that was a mountaintop experience. A mountaintop experience. Oh, by the way, let me tell you about one more mountaintop, just real quick, okay? There's a hill called Calvary. And on that mountaintop, Jesus died. And if you can get Calvary in your heart and in your mind, it will change your world. You can be on the mountaintop with Jesus. You can. Father, thank you. Thank you for your grace and your love to us. Thank you for showing us your word and allowing us to see the impact of it. How Moses and Elijah revealed to us that Jesus had fulfilled everything. Everything. We do not wait for some time in the future for fulfillment to come, because he has fulfilled all the law and all the prophets. Father, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for letting these three witnesses be there that day. These three that would be able to say, yes, yes, this happened. We saw it. It is true. God spoke that Jesus is a son. And then, Father, what an amazing witness you have given. You said that this is your son. This. Jesus is the one you sent for us. You loved him and you loved us. And you still love us. May we move to the mountaintop with Jesus. May we celebrate these things. May they be true in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Would you stand?